You're listening to the Yacht Racing Life podcast, the show for racing sailors everywhere. Featuring exclusive stories and interviews from across the world of competitive sailing. Hosted by British sailing journalist Justin Chisholm. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Sam Goodchild, welcome back to the Yacht Racing Life podcast. It's been a good few years since we recorded one together. And back then, I remember you were still dreaming about doing the Vendée Globe. And now here you are, you've completed your first Vendée Globe. So first of all, congratulations on all of that. Amazing performance. And how are you feeling right now? Has it sunk in yet?
Hi, Justin. Thanks for having me. I was thinking about this morning, actually, and I probably haven't spent enough time appreciating it, to be honest. As life does to us, you kind of get back and have spent the last 3 months, probably even 6 months with the lead up to the race, kind of putting everything which isn't a priority off to one side and forgetting about it. And then suddenly you come back to life and there's quite a lot of things to do and a lot of things to catch up on, and actually appreciating the fact that I've just completed a Vendée Globe, which is something I was aiming to do, working towards and hoping to do for the last 15, 20 years, basically. It's kind of quite hard to get your head around.
Yeah, I'm sure. It must have been lovely to be back with your family after that length of time at sea.
Yeah, it's definitely good to see the family in again. I've got a two-year-old, so disappearing for best part of 3 months is quite a large part of her life. So, yeah, she's changed. And then obviously my wife and the bigger girl, it's just nice to catch up with them and see them again. So, yeah, it's definitely a great moment getting them back on board the boat coming up the channel.
And the little one, does she have an appreciation of what you've been doing? Can she comprehend it, do you think?
Time for her is before now and after now. So disappearing for 3 months was obviously felt like forever for her, which it probably was. At the preschool she's in and at home, they followed the Vendée Globe and the boat and stuff. So she comes out with things like, oh, are you going on your boat again? Are you coming back? When are you coming back? Is it going to be like last time? She can say Vendée Globe now. So she talks about the Vendée Globe and things. And I went to pick her up from preschool the other day and one of the other kids was like, oh, you're not on your boat? Yes, Haley's daddy. So, yeah, it's a two-year-old's perception of things, but it's quite cute and try and explain it to her, but it's not always that easy.
It's a good indicator, though, of how difficult that phrase work-life balance is for somebody who's a professional sailor. I mean, how do you deal with that?
To be perfectly honest, without a wife at home that was expecting and ready and strong enough to support that, then it doesn't work, I don't think, is the short answer. It's not easy. It's work-life balance, but sometimes you disappear for 3 months and sometimes you'll be at home for 3 months. So it's quite a difficult one to find. I laugh quite regularly about the fact that Vendée Globe is probably harder for her than it was for me. And in many ways, I think it actually was.
Tell me a bit more about this Wonder Woman. Where did you meet her?
She's French, so she met in France when I was sailing the Figaro circuit. She's a yoga teacher and a very calm and grounding character, which helps me when through the ups and downs of a professional sporting career. As you can imagine, there's ups and downs and in equal measures. So, yeah, no, she's fortunately enjoys spending time with the kids and enjoys me coming back and giving her a bit of time for herself as well.
Now we should. I've got to ask you her name. We can't keep calling her.
So her name's Julie.
Julie. Yeah. And Julie is a sailor. Did you meet through sailing or just through being in France together?
No, not at all. Not at all a sailor. I've taken her sailing a few times, but it's more out of interest than anything else. She's not a sailor, but it's good as well to not go home and just talk about boats and change the subject every now and again.
So she's lived this dream of doing the Vendée Globe with you, because I guess when you met, it was still just a dream. Maybe there was a plan.
When we met back in, I don't remember even when, 2013 maybe. She was aware of it was something I wanted to do. Whether she fully grasped what that meant, I don't know. But uh, But yeah, I mean, it's something I've always lived with, and especially since I've known her. So yeah, she's supported me every step of the way and through the ups and downs and the easier bits and the hard bits. But for sure, there's a lot more passion driving me to go do a Vendée Globe than there is for her to spend 3 months at home looking after the kids by herself. So doesn't mean it's always easy, but even if there's a great bit of support around it.
Now, let's talk about the race itself. Your final position was ninth, but for a long time you were battling for fourth with Jeremy Bayou on Chiral. And then you had some pretty catastrophic mainsail damage. Looking back on that, I saw the videos and you dealt with it really well. And when you came ashore, you seemed very pragmatic about it, that, you know, you'd already kind of processed it maybe. But that must have been a really crushing blow at that point.
Yes. I mean, it's quite an interesting one because, like you say, you're pragmatic and kind of digested it already by the time it hit the dock. And it's, I mean, the mainsail broking happened maybe 10 days before I've hit the dock. So you've got quite a lot of time to digest it. It's not like a sport which takes a 20-minute race or a half an hour race where you are in the adrenaline and you get asked interviews as the adrenaline's still coming down. I mean, we had quite a lot of time to digest it. But that said, I mean, when the mainsail broke, it's not that it's easy, but it very quickly becomes of, I've got a job here and you've got to figure out how you're going to fix the mainsail. What are the options? What have you got on board? But it's very technical. You get into there's something I need to do and you need to do it as fast as possible and as safely as possible and as efficiently as possible. So you're very much into an action of fixing things as opposed to into a crying in a corner, wondering how this is going to end sort of thing, which helps digest it for sure. I spent 48 hours basically fixing the mainsail from the moment it broke to putting it back up again. And in those 48 hours, I did nothing but eat, sleep and repair and a lot of WhatsApping with the shore crew, but only about the mainsail and nothing else. So by the time you get to the end of the 48 hours, you kind of had a bit of time to digest and think about it. And yeah, it's a nasty blow, but fairly quickly my way of working through those is kicking yourself into action and into gear. And that's quite easy when you've got a fairly obvious job on your hands.
That sort of damage to the mainsail, was that something you guys had a strategy for as a team?
It's something we'd spoken about. What happens if you break your mainsail in two? Because it's obviously happened before and will happen again. And exactly how it happens, where it happens, etc., is never quite the same. But yeah, I mean, we basically brought enough material and brought enough glue to say worst case scenario is fixing a mainsail which is broken in two pieces. How would we do that? And that's where we got to. Yeah,
just talk us through what actually happened to cause that mainsail damage, because I think you described it as a bit of a whoopsie or something on the video saw.
Yeah, so basically we were going through this quite a big low off the Azores. And there was, beforehand we had a choice as to maybe try and go round the worst of the wind and the worst of the sea state. And in the end we chose not to, we because we were several boats that make the same choice. Not to, because basically it meant you would maybe have a bit less sea state and a bit less wind, but you get run over by the system earlier and end up beating up wind in 45 knots upwind off Cap Finisterre for a day or two longer, which didn't sound very appealing. So stuck between a little bit of a rock and a hard place. So I ended up going into the low, basically as close as you could get to the eye, and jibing out and trying to stay in front of it. And so we saw on the weather file, we saw 7-meter waves. And basically a squall came through, which had 60 knots in it. I was two reefs and J3, which is not our storm jib, but I was VMG downwind, so I'm obviously quite windy, and I decided to furl the J3. And the fact that I bore away a bit too far meant that the boat was a bit unstable while I was furling the jib, and I just got picked up by a wave on the back corner, kind of three-quarters hour aft corner, and it just spun the boat round to leeward. And the pilot pushes the helm over to bring it back to course, but just the wave kind of just makes the mainsail flap across and flap back. And because it was 60 knots of wind and two reefs, but it was quite a violent flap. And when it hit the backstay, which was to windward, it broke the battens. And when it hit the the shrouds to leeward when it came back again. It broke the battens even more, and then the mainsail split in two. So, I mean, in hindsight, it could have done so many, you can obviously do so many things differently in hindsight, but probably the biggest thing is maybe going to the third reef, which was something I was trying to avoid, because the mainsail then goes behind the shrouds, and to hoist the mainsail, you have to go head to wind again. So it's quite a faff of a maneuver when it's blowing 50 knots. So I tried to avoid that. And yeah, I mean, hindsight is probably to accept that loss compared to ripping a mainsail in half. But I spoke to Jeremy Bayou, who was a few miles away when it happened, and he was exactly the same as me. He failed his J3 to go through the squalls of the front and stayed two reefs. So that helps me a little bit digest it and think it wasn't that stupid what I was doing, but there you go.
Those decisions, I can't even imagine having to make those decisions. Even if you were surrounded by a crew and people to discuss it with, I mean, is that something you do discuss with the shore team?
No. Basically, anything which impacts your race and how you race, you can't have help and advice on. And so that's weather, that's strategy, that's what sail you should put up, when you should put up, when you should do a sail change. I mean, the sailing world's too small to bend those rules, so we were quite strict with them, because you don't know who you work with now and who they're going to be working with next time, and whether you're friends with them now, who you're going to be friends with next time. You never know. So it's not something you even play with, because the gains are so little for such a high risk. So yeah, we kind of kept it very, and we had in every group of discussions, we had several people in, so there was a little bit of auto kind of management of that to make sure there was no stepping over the line sort of thing. So no, on that side of things, there was something which stays on board. Yeah.
So the repair of the mainsail itself, I saw the videos. It looked not the ideal spot to be trying to do a sail repair. Just, can you describe that environment for people who might not have seen that video?
It's even hard to describe in a video, to be honest. But so obviously you've got to get the mainsail off the mast, because you can't fix it in the boom or in the lazies. The tear was over 3 meters long from leech to luff. So you had to find an area on the boat which was over 3 meters long. I did it on the coach roof, which wasn't quite a flat surface, but at least it was near enough. And so when you've got, I don't know how many meters, it must have been 10 odd meters of mainsail off the mast, and you're trying to manage it on the deck, you've still got over 30 knots over the deck, 30 knots of wind over the deck, and still 5-6 meter waves by that stage. I mean, it was just difficult managing that bit of sail. So you end up trying to tie it down in all the corners. And then we had waves breaking into the back of the boat, which would fill up the cot with water. And then you'd surf down a wave, you nosedive into the back of the next wave. So you then find yourself underwater from water come the other way. It was just it wasn't very sane, but what's funny with the Vendée Globe, quite a few times I was like, well, I haven't got a choice. So, I mean, you can sit here complaining about it and saying how bad it is, but the reality is no one else is going to do it for you. And if you don't do it, it's not going to happen. So get on with it. It was fairly full on, and I found myself, I remember I came up on deck with the first patch of a meter by a meter, covered in Sikaflex, and went to stick it on the sail and nosedived into a wave, and the mainsail started floating away, and then the patch got washed away, and I had to go grab it. And then I was like, this is never going to happen. This is just it's not going to happen. And a miracle it did. But it was not ideal conditions for fixing a mainsail, let's put it that way.
How much confidence did you have in it once it had, I guess you needed to leave it to cure and dry and all of that good stuff. How much confidence did you have?
I'm very little, to be honest. Very, very little. There's bits of patches which I had to rip back up and glue back down, because 3/4 of the patch was an air bubble. And you start doing the calculator. Okay, Sikaflex, which is glued well, will do, I don't know how many kilos per square centimeter. You're like, that'd be fine. And then you look at your patch, you're like, there's maybe only 5 square centimeters properly stuck down on that. Is that enough? And I was expecting it to hull, but not the whole way, and not for very long, and was just crossing my fingers it wouldn't explode in two pieces as I hoisted it. So, it was, I hoped with all I could that it was going to hold together and expected for it to not last very long. And I just kind of had in my mind, if I could do the 100 miles to or 150 miles upwind to Cap Finisterre, then after that it was downwind and you can goose wing and I'll make it to the finish, but and a bit slowly, but at least I'll make it. And fortunately, it actually held together, and the shore crew delivered the boat back to Lorient, reaching in 20 knots of wind with my repaired mainsail up. So it,
It's got years of life left in it.
I honestly, when I hoisted it three reefs in 35 knots upwind or reaching, and you just don't sheet on, you let it flap a bit, and you just don't flap too much, and you're just trying to not load it up. And then I ended up going upwind of 45 knots with two reefs in, and then I ended up doing jibes downwind, which is obviously worst case scenario for these mainsails is when they flick from one side to the other. And the first jibe, I put three reefs in and was really careful. And then by the finish line, I was doing jibes with the full main up, and it was almost a game to see if I could try and break it. And it was just, it's incredible how it held, actually. But again,
so you were in full race mode once you'd done this repair and tested it a bit.
No, I mean, it was gradual. It was, like I said, I started three reefs and then slowly kind of built confidence and sheeted on more and built confidence and sheeted on more. By the last 12 hours, and I was in race mode, but it was a bit late by then.
A top 10 finish is still massively credible. What were your aspirations when you went into this race, other than just finishing it?
I had two objectives. One of them was finishing it, and the other one was enjoying it, and that was it. I didn't have a result in mind. Obviously, you want to win. That's what you aim for when you're racing a boat, but I was kind of also very aware of my experience, the boat's capacities. It was a second generation boat, and yeah, I was like, you can have a great race and not feel, you won't feel bad about it, but you are struck lucky, and you can have an awful result and think that you sailed a really great race and were tidy and maybe a bit unlucky or some things didn't go your way, but you're proud of what you did. And I mean, it's probably more on that side of things. And yeah, ninth, like you say, it could have been fourth or fifth, and it didn't happen, but still, I'm happy with how the race went. I managed to enjoy it. I went all the way around, and it's more than respectable result. So,
and for much of the early part of that race, in fact, for the bulk of the race, you were up with the leading pack. You were leading the race on several occasions, you know, which had people like me cheering from the sidelines. Yeah. Of course,
thanks.
You seem very relaxed about that, and I like the fact that you said, well, yeah, I'm leading, but it doesn't really matter because we're racing around the world. You have to feel like that, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it was something I'd specifically worked on and prepared for with the mental preparation coach I worked with was just that, because I'd had a few good results in the lead up to it, and it was obviously an option that I could find myself in a good position that happens. And it was, well, hang on a minute, this is, don't let that get into your head as, okay, well, look, you're now at the equator and you're in first place, so this is yours, you can win it, because it's a long way to go. There's so many outside things that can happen. So I was quite happy in the way that was managed, to not let it get into my head and let me get overexcited about it. And as expected, I think way across here, through the doldrums in first, and as we got into the southern trade winds and the wind picked up and the wind angle came forward, the new baits came past one by one, and I spent the next 5 weeks being overtaken. But so it was as expected. Even if it's not always easy and fun, it was as expected. Yeah.
They still had to overtake you. They were still behind you at that point. So
yeah, exactly. And I mean, when you look at someone like Boris Herrmann, who had a bad first week of the race, he paid for that for the whole race basically and never managed to recover from it. So yes, it's part of the race. And you could say with my older boat, the first 2 weeks I had in great form and the conditions where I was much less penal or had much less of a penalty in boat speed, meant that I could hold on to a top 10 place all the way to the finish. So
tell us about that boat. It was Thomas Royon's boat from the previous edition. And we'll get into a bit of that whole two boat team aspect, which I think is really interesting. But that was a quick boat only 4 years ago. Has the whole thing moved on so much that the newer boats are just completely in another league?
They're not in another league. In certain conditions, they're in another league. Basically, the last Vendée Globe, the 2020 Vendée Globe, they had a bunch of issues through sea state, going through waves and keeping high averages and low angles downwind in the Southern Ocean, pretty much. And so a lot of the new boats had aimed towards trying to fix that deficit, which comes at a price because you lose some hull stability. At the same time, the foils are taking a step forward as well, where people are kind of starting to converge on what foils work and what foils don't work. And the new rule that came in that limits the power of them, which meant kind of converged towards something which was a bit deeper and limited in power because they're all about the same power. That meant I kind of had two big Achilles heels, which was the hull shape going through water, or going through waves rather, and the foils, which were less stable and more prone to ventilating at high speeds, and even more so when you add weight of sea state into that as well, because I had much shallower foils. The first 2 weeks of the race where we were downwind in between 5 and 15 knots, my boat basically had no weakness at all compared to the newer foiling boats, and that was why I was able to hold my own. Yeah.
You mentioned that the foils were less powerful this time around. There was a rule to make it like that. Was that to protect the masts on the boat? Because I remember there was an issue that the masts effectively became the fuse on the boat.
It was to protect the mast and all the rest of the gear around the mast and everything, and just kind of limit it somewhere, because I started seeing foils coming out on what is now Bure Valley, what was Occitan, which had, and I think the old Icare Paprec as well, had a huge writing moment from the foils, which was just insane and a lot above everyone else. And they're basically sailing the boat to alarms most of the time. It's like, oh, that's a bit too much, let's pull the foil in or ease the sheet a bit. And there was, the class decided to limit it somewhere so you don't end up with it just going to bigger foils and spending more and more money and taking more and more risks. So yeah, it got limited for several reasons, but that was one of them. Yeah.
Tell me about the boat down below your living area. I saw a video that Matt Sheehan and yourself did before you left in Lorient. So I have a reasonably good picture, but it looked like a very kind of secure environment, if it's possible to have that on a Vendée Globe boat.
It was designed for single-handed sailing, that's for sure. So it's all very compact. The chart table seat, the cockpit, the winches, the pedestal, and the bed are all in a very small surface area. You don't need to have a cockpit where people can circulate, and you can have a pit man and a winch man and a helmsman. It was designed to basically not have a helm station because you're under pilot most of the time, and to have all your winches very close to the pedestal so you can basically strip a winch or load a winch without having to move your feet from where you're turning the handles. So it's very practical. It was made for someone that isn't a 1.90 meter tall. So I spent most of the around the world bent over. Yeah, like me. It's very practical in single-handed sailing, but it was not very comfortable. And the part of the hull shape differences between the new boats and the old boats translates into comfort as well, because I was much more prone to nose diving and much more prone to slamming, doesn't help at all for life on board. So it wasn't the easiest boat, and it's known for being one of the more uncomfortable boats, but it comes at the, it's a side effect of being able to go fast and flat water and medium winds. So it's not all a bad thing.
And that nosediving issue, I noticed that everything was facing aft, so your seat faced aft, so that you didn't get catapulted forward. So in a lot of ways, you sail around the world backwards.
The chart table seat, it was back to the row, back to the way we're going. And yeah, if you, like you say, one of your biggest issues, whether it's nosediving, whether it's hitting something, was always to be next to something solid. So if the boat stopped, you would stop with it and not fly until the next solid object in front of you. So yeah, it was definitely something which was kept in mind when we were chart table and the cockpit kind of standby area, if you like. It was always about having your shoulder or something or your back against something hard. Yeah.
How much modification did you make to that boat to kind of personalize it for yourself? Were you able to do much?
We didn't do massive mods. It was all life on board sort of things. The chart table seat, we picked the shoulders up a little bit because Thomas is a little bit shorter than I am. Worked on the bed and worked on all that comfort side of things, basically trying to keep the cockpit as dry as possible and trying to have some standby and some resting areas which were as reasonable as possible. So that's where all the energy and effort went. These things are always never ending, aren't they? If you had more time, more money, more resources, you do always do more, but we did what we could in the kind of envelope of time and resources we had.
Let's just dig in a little bit to this two boat team that you had. I call it vulnerable. Is it vulnerable or vulnerable? I'm not sure.
I'm English, so I call it vulnerable.
Vulnerable. That was yourself and Thomas. Tell me about that. Were you able to two boat tune effectively? Was there some advantages to that?
That was the whole idea, and there was a lot behind it, really. But yeah, in terms of sailing together, it was great. We basically never left the dock on our own. We were always two boat testing in one way or another. There's obviously days which are more focused towards technical tests, but primarily, yeah, it was sailing as much as possible with two boats and being able to compare performances between a boat which, like you said, was one of the fastest boats, if not the fastest boat of the older generation, and Thomas' new boat, which had basically been designed on the learnings from him sailing on my boat for the previous 4 years. That was really interesting. The other thing which is interesting is running the team in the same building. So you've got a lot more specialist resources at hand. Remember we had three or four person in the composites team. And when you have an issue on one boat, you can suddenly have four people on board in that day or that afternoon and be sailing the next day, as opposed to have to look to see who's available and who you can employ for a two or three days mission to get something fixed. And same on electronics and same on kind of all the big jobs. And when you look at it on paper, you think, oh, you could save money. But actually what happens is you end up spending not much less money, but you have much higher quality resources at hand much quicker. So you're much more reactive and you've got more people around the table.
How many people make up that team?
We were roughly 30 people full time. And in a refit period, we were up to 35 and in a quieter period, slightly under 30. But yeah, an average of 30 people full time.
Now, you mentioned a couple of times the pilot. I have a few questions to ask you about that, because the last time we spoke on the podcast, you were telling me about the pilots and kind of educating me about it, really, because I didn't appreciate just how sophisticated they become back then. So I guess my question is, 4 years later, or at least 4 years later, has it all moved on dramatically since then? How good are the pilots now?
I don't think it's moved on dramatically. It's been about kind of improving what we've got, learning how to use them better and learning how to teach them better, if you like, whether that's the settings, and there's lots of settings. I've fortunately used the same make of pilot for the last 4 or 5 years, so learning how it works and what its pros and cons are and how to make it work best has been interesting, and I don't think it's revolutionized since then. It's just really learning how to optimize the settings of it to be as good as possible. Yeah.
What make is it that you use?
I use Madantec, which is a French company, which was developed in the last 5-10 years, and it's an impressive pilot, and it's got a lot of settings to it, which I don't understand all of them, probably not even half of them. But learning how to try and get it. I mean, it's basically sea state is the biggest issue, because there's obviously the wind calculation and getting it to work to the wind, but it's how to get it to work to sea state, and sometimes gusts as well, how it manages gusts. But it's pretty impressive what they can do these days. And I mean, the whole Vendée Globe, I don't think I drove once apart from, I never drove.
Really? Oh, that was going to be my next question. How much time did you spend driving? Just never.
I'm trying to think of one time. I think the only time I drove was when the pilot cut out for one reason or another, because there was an electronic blackout or because the sensor had gone down or something. But there was no point where I took the helm and said, oh, let's have a drive and see how the boat feels. And we had load sensor on the helm. So you, for how much load is in the helm, you look at a number and whether it's got a lot of angle on it because there's too much lee helm or weather helm, we got numbers on that as well. Apart from when there was a problem, I never drove.
I want to just walk through your build-up over the years to this Vendée Globe campaign, because there's been a number of them, and I may have jotted down a few of them. Certainly Class 40, but I think before Class 40, there was probably Figaro, was there?
It depends where you start. I mean, the 2011, I did my first Figaro and my first Jack Vabre with Concise in a Class 40. So it sort of happened a bit at the same time. But I started professionally offshore racing, if you like. It was 2011, yeah.
And you, at that point, you'd made the move to just move to France. You'd made that decision to go there because it's the centre of all things offshore sailing.
In 2011, I was with the Artemis Offshore Academy, and part of that was training in France in the winter. So we came down in December 2010 to Le Grand Mot in the south of France to join a Figaro training centre where there was 10 to 15 Figaros. And so we spent 2 or 3 months there training, and then we did the Figaro circuit, which was mostly in France throughout the season. But I mean, only time I had time off, I went back to the UK, and I moved to France in 2015. I was with Maffre for the 14-15 Ocean Race, and I got let go from the team in Cape Town, and I basically found myself in December 2014 being like, well, I've got no job, I don't know what I'm going to do next. I wasn't expecting this, and I was like, well, L'Oréal seems to be the place to be. If you want to go offshore sailing, I'll go spend a bit of time there and see what happens, and I've been here basically since then.
Yeah, and you've made a life for yourself there. You also taught yourself to speak French, or you were taught to speak French. Was that very important early on?
So I can't remember what stage it was. It was maybe not that long ago, 3-4 years ago, that you realize how much you missed not speaking French. Because you go to, I remember, I was, when you go to these Figaro briefings and debriefings, you sit in a room for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and at the end of it, some guy comes and says, oh, we're going to do this, this, and this. And they summarize it to you in 3 minutes. You know, okay, well, great. I don't know why that took 2 hours, but thanks for the information. And a debrief, the same. And then little by little, you start realizing how much you miss by not speaking French in terms of what gets. It's when Jan Elias says, oh, when someone says, oh, I was ballasted there. And Jan Elias goes, oh, I'd never put the ballast in at that stage. And you're, oh, I might note that down, shall I? And you miss that in a debrief or a summary of a debrief. Or when you go have a coffee and you start talking about, oh, what's this new sale that's coming in next week and whether you should give it a go and how the new sailmaker is coming and maybe you should test it. And, oh, I didn't know he was coming, so now I'm too late on the list and I didn't get to test the new sail. And yeah, it's just all the details, which it's not, and none of it's people trying to hide information from you, none of it's kind of bad intentioned, but it's just you miss things when you don't speak the language, because you, the official stuff and the important stuff gets translated, but it's the devil is in the detail always, and that's where you can learn so much, just by kind of understanding what people say and a bit more in between the lines. Yeah.
There must be an element of it too, that being located at the heart of it in L'Oréal, you're in the mix of it all. You're available for opportunities that arise. People know that you're there. They know you're available. I'm thinking of the stuff you did with the Ultims, you know, to be called up to be part of those crews. It's not going to happen if you're sitting in the UK, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I came back after that Ocean Race experience or Volvo experience with Maffre, and that was with Mishdej, and Mishdej came home with me, or we came home together, if you like. And at the same time, he was just selling his Mod 70 to Fado, who Brian was the skipper of, and Brian was like, oh, I'm looking for any youngsters to come sailing. Have you got any ideas? And Mish was like, oh, there's that an English guy down the road that did Figaro sailing. He's got some time. And yeah, for sure. I mean, being there and then, and oh, can you come do a day's work? And then, oh, well, you seem to ask the right questions. Can you come back tomorrow? And then, oh, we're doing a transat next week. Do you want to join? I was like, yeah. And little by little, it comes more and more. And Spindrift, for example, I sent them an email and was like, oh, I've been selling a Mod 70 with Brian Thompson for 3 years. Are you looking for anyone? And I got an email back an hour later saying, oh, we're looking for a bowman. Are you interested in being a bowman? And it's timing. But yeah, I mean, being in the right place definitely helps for sure.
And have you pretty much said yes to every opportunity? Has there been any that you've turned down?
I remember there's a stage I started being like, I'm going to have to stop saying no sometime because I've said yes for the last 10 years. There's a point when you can't say yes to everything. And then there's a point when you need to be a little bit reasonable about where you spend your time and energy. So yeah, little by little, I remember saying the first no to a good project that was available to do it. And it hit me. I was like, hang on a minute. This is a new thing. Why are you saying no to going sailing?
Yeah. That must be killing you. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not easy when you, yeah, but it's always for a good reason, isn't it? I've always had this, been fairly stubborn-minded as to where I'm trying to go and what I'm trying to do and accepting only things that help me to make it towards that goal and that objective.
And the goal and the objective has been the Vendée Globe. That's never changed, I don't think.
No, that's, yeah, stubborn, as I said, is that's not changed, and it's always kind of, I remember asking Mish when he called me and said, do you want to go sail Mod 70 to Brian Thompson? I was like, it's not a monohull and it's not single-handed. Why should I do it? And he said I should do it. So I did. But yeah, it was my first question was, how is that going to help me do a Vendée Globe?
And have you had the sense over the years, because you did some stuff in Ocean 50s, which again is multi-hull stuff. Have you always felt like you were moving towards the goal, or was it still a light in the distance that wasn't getting any nearer?
I mean, there's definitely times when I started saying I'm never going to make it. Like, I'm not getting anywhere closer to it. It's just getting more and more difficult. And the longer you try and the closer you don't get, you get to a point you're like, well, is this ever going to happen? And then when you do finally get the phone call, you don't really believe it. So it creeps up on you gradually.
And I guess a lot of it is positioning yourself and presenting yourself as somebody that the sponsors, you know, want to associate themselves with.
Yeah, for sure. There's a big part of that and the whole sponsorship side of things, because obviously these projects happen from being financed, and for financing, there needs to be return on investment for the sponsors. So, yeah, there's a large part of that. The sport is becoming more and more professional slowly but surely, which is good for myself, because it means your results do have an impact and it's not just how well you do Instagram. So it's not, you obviously need to find the right balance between that, because then I don't win everything, but I've worked as kind of a better and better reputation for myself, if you like, on the water, and try and back it up with something which sponsors can relate to and work on as well. And it's not always easy trying to find the balance, but I'm fortunate to have found the sponsors and made this one work for the last Vendée Globe. Yeah.
When you say the sport's becoming more professional, it seems to me it's always been pretty professional. I'm interested in what you meant by that.
How can I say it without upsetting anyone? Previously, a Vendée Globe was a skipper who would buy a boat or rent money to buy a boat, find a sponsor, and he'd run his team. He'd employ people. It was his boat. It was his team. It was his Vendée Globe, and he'd do everything, which is being paid to go sailing. So it's professional. But little by little, there's more and more teams like Banque Populaire or like Gitana, and like the TR Racing team I was in, where they've got a team which works, and you're employed because, you know, they know you're going to do your job and sail the boat properly, and you're not there to help run a team. You're not there to help do anything. You're there to help to win races and sail the boat. And that style of project has been more and more kind of common as we go on. And previously it wouldn't have worked because the sponsorship goes through a human contact between the head of a company and a sailor. And so you have a Mike Golding and an Ecover, for example, or a Michel Desjoyeaux and Foncier and things like that. And little by little, it's becoming more of a professional sports team.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I like what you said. It's not just how many followers you've got on Instagram, because I think we all want to get away from that whole aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not what motivates me, and I don't criticize anyone that goes down that side of things, because it's if that fills everyone's objectives, then it's great and it brings more people into sailing. So, you know, I'm not going to criticize it, but it's not what motivates me anyway. I'm not trying to be famous or trying to be liked, or I enjoy the sport of sailing and enjoy doing it professionally and doing it to a higher level as possible, and try and deliver to sponsors as much as I can in my way of doing things. And yeah, it also works. Avon the Globe works because we're not all exactly the same. So you need a little bit of everything as well.
Now, I want to go back quickly because I've remembered, I forgot to ask you a question when we were talking about the autopilots on the boat. On a podcast interview recently, we had a guy from American Magic who was talking about how AI and virtual twins, you know, they could simulate this boat sailing around the course to a point where it was sailing the boat better than the sailors were, and the sailors were taking tips from the way that this boat, this virtual boat, was being sailed. Is that something you can see happening in the Amoka world?
Yes. In short, when and how, I don't know. But I mean, definitely, I think it's a technological sport with innovation. And obviously AI is something which is relatively new and growing rapidly in power and in use. And I mean, if they're using it in the America's Cup, I haven't heard that interview, so I'll have to go back and listen to it. But yeah, I mean, there's no reason it can't be applied to what we're doing. There's obviously going to be obstacles with that, whether it's sea state and things a bit differently, but there's no reason it can't be used. And before we started asking ourselves questions as to where and how that can be used, whether it's on routing software, whether it's on flight control, if you like, even if we're not fully flying, there is elements of flight control between your foils and your ballast and your keel and things. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely things to be learned from it for sure.
Now, I don't get to talk to many people who've been in the Southern Ocean, so I'm going to ask you about the Southern Ocean, because I think people are really interested to know about that piece of water. It won't have been your first time down there, but was it maybe your first time all the way through, to make it all the way through?
It was the first time by myself, that's for sure. And I did the ocean race with Holcim 2 years ago. So we went from Cape Town and round Cape Horn. Okay. Which is 90% of it, if you like, if you don't count the South Atlantic on the way down. But yeah, so it's the first time to go all the way around the world and be in the Southern Ocean on my own. Yeah.
Tell me about what it's like down there. Is it very different to everywhere else on the planet?
It's almost mentally where it's the biggest difference, because you're just so far from anything and it just makes you think about things a little bit differently. You think, oh, if I have an issue now, there's not going to be a ship coming past tomorrow. There's not going to be a helicopter here in 4 hours' time. I'm here until either one of my competitors comes and picks me up, and he's on his own on a 60-foot boat that he's struggling to manage by himself, no matter, on a rescue mission. So, I mean, that has an impact. The other impact is on weather forecasts, where they're less predictable than what we get used to in the North Atlantic, where there's a lot more input and there's a lot more experience. So yeah, I mean, the weather's a bit different, and the weather systems are much bigger and much faster moving, because there's just much less land masses around. So yeah, there's some real differences, but I mean, when it comes down to it, there's wind and waves. There's only a certain number of dynamics that can be changed physically. But yeah, mentally it's different. It's a different way of managing sailing, a different way of managing things. I mean, what I found the most incredible and the most impressive is when you do a route de rame or a Jacques Vabre and you see over 30 knots on the wind file, you start kind of getting a bit twitchy. As, oh, there's going to be a start, they're going to cancel it, they're going to delay it, what's going to happen? And in the Southern Ocean, I think we saw over 40 knots six, seven times, and waves up to 8-9 meters. And in the Atlantic, we'd never see that. You'd never even go sailing in it. You'd just go, well, we'll stay on the dock, shall we? And in the South, you can ask yourself 10 times how to go around it, but in the end, you end up going through it, and it's not actually that bad. The risk
is not that bad.
It's obviously quite high risk, but yeah, when things go to plan, it's actually the boats are designed for it, and they can make it no problem. Yeah.
What is it like sailing one of those boats in those sort of conditions? You must be constantly on edge, just trying to make sure that you've minimized all the risk.
Yeah, it's all about preparation. It's all about being ready for what's next. And I mean, the Imokas are designed to be sailed single-handed. So I'm not saying it's easy, but it's if you do all the processes in the right order, and nothing goes wrong, and you don't forget anything, and you don't wait too long for the wind to build or anything, it's quite smooth. But the big issue becomes when there's a spanner in the works, whether it's of your own fault, forgetting something or doing something wrong or pushing a bit hard. And that's when a small issue can become a very big issue very quickly. There's obviously mechanical issues and running into stuff, which is a whole different element. But just in terms of unforced errors, if you like, that's when the boat can very quickly go from everything's under control to you've been bitten pretty hard sort of situation. In a very short space of time. So, yeah, I guess that's the big difference.
Yeah, you had a bit of luck down there. I'm going to say it was luck. You had a headsail go over the side and it didn't destroy itself on the foil. And I could see the relief, hear it in your voice and see it on your face in the video that you sent back. But that must have been grueling work to get that back on board on your own.
Yeah, so, I mean... I was in bed. Obviously, it never happens when you're expecting it, does it? And I heard the heli go out the cockpit. Oh, no, that's not good. And I came up on deck, and you see this 180 square meter sail in the water next to the boat. And you're like, well, okay, I'm going to cut it off because I'm never going to get that on board. Where should I cut it to lose as little as possible and leave as little as possible in the water? You start thinking about that. And then I thought, like, hang on a minute. It'd be stupid not to even try trying to get it on board because you can't just cut a sail and leave it in the water just like that. So I was like, okay, how can you try? And you start pulling on the halyard and you're like, hang on a minute, I'm not going to start lifting up this fishing net out of the water with tons and tons of water in it. It's just going to break the halyard. And ended up going quite well, actually. I don't know why, but yeah. I mean,
what was the technique? So
the technique was initially to tack the boat because the sail was being washed under the boat because it fell to leeward and it was getting washed under the boat. So I pinned in the main to tack the boat. So then it was being washed out to windward and I was drifting away from it as opposed to on top of it. Then I put the first thing I did actually before any of that was lift the foil up. So it was not going to, so the tip of the foil wasn't going to go through the sail. Then I put a mouse line on the halyard. So the sail, so I could let the halyard out and it could sit on top of the surface of the water as opposed to make a big pocket. And then I sheeted on as hard as I could to get the foot out of the water and as much of the sail out of the water naturally by the sheet and the tack, which are going to higher load points. And then I went from the bow and worked aft in a sort of a wooling, a spinnaker sort of sail with sail ties. So I'd go a meter, bunch it together, put a sail tie around it. Another meter, bunch it together, put a sail tie around it, and worked aft. And by the time I got to the clue point, I was like, hang on a minute, this is actually coming to me. And just pulled in the head of the sail, and it took 45 minutes or something. I was amazed.
Wow.
And it's another one of those situations. You're like, well, you can look at this and say how hard and difficult this looks, but no one's going to solve it. No one's going to come help you. So you might as well try something and get on with it. And it's amazing how you can come up with solutions which seemed impossible to begin with. Whether it would work a second time exactly the same way, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, like you say, I was very lucky to not have the foil that went through the sail and I hoisted the sail a few days later, filled it up and it's still in its sail bag today.
I'm going to retract my lucky thing. It sounds like that was superb.
Well, I mean, it could have easily fell on the foil and ripped in half. So as always, it's probably a bit of both, but there's definitely some luck involved.
So are you going to patent that method of retrieving a sail now, the good child method?
Maybe I should, yeah. Maybe I should.
The rest of that race was pretty exciting to follow, just generally, and particularly with your battle with Jeremy. On the approach, though, you were incapacitated with the mainsail break. On the approach to Le Sable d'Olonne, what was the feelings? You were kind of closing in on Justine Mitreau, but she managed to finish eighth and you finished ninth. What were the emotions going through your head over that last kind of 48 hours?
I'm a little bit disappointed, to be honest, because I had this imagination of, you know, you can see the finish line that's coming towards you, and you've got a little bit of an hour where you're, it's basically the race is done and you've made it. And you can have a little bit of time on your own just to kind of decompress and think about it. And it never happened for several reasons, because I was catching up Justine, because I spent the whole day waiting for wind, and then suddenly the wind came in about 20 miles from the finish line. And I had 2 hours to make it into the tide for the Sable d'Olonne, or I was going to have to spend the whole night at sea. And then the next day was going to be 40 knots of wind, and I'd have to miss the if I couldn't get in through the breaking waves off the breakwater, then I'd have to go to La Rochelle like a couple other boats did. And so when the wind came in, it was very much a race against the clock. By which time we'd all given up the idea of making it into the channel. And all of a sudden I was like, look, the wind's just picked up and the clouds have cleared. Like, I'm pretty sure this wind's going to hold for 2 hours. And if I can not slow down, then I'll make it. So the shore team were all in panic mode as well, because they'd kind of given up hope. And trying to do an ETA when 1 minute you're going 2 knots, the next minute you're going 25 knots is easier said than done. And so, yeah, it ended up a race to the clock to get across the finish line. This Vendée Globe, they had a heavy weather finish line, which was 4 miles offshore. So I crossed the finish line on my own with no one there, no committee, no support team. Sent a WhatsApp to the race organizer saying, I think I'm finished. Do you agree? And he's like, oh, we've got a 1 minute delay with your tracker, so I'll let you know in a minute. They sent me a message being, oh, yeah, I think you finished as well. I was like, okay, I think I finished as well. So if we both think we've finished, it's probably a good sign, isn't it? And then saw the technical rib coming out towards me, and there was 4 meter waves, and I was going at 20 knots, still trying to do that 4 miles to the entrance of the channel and not miss out on the tide going up the channel. And then dropped the main, the shore crew jumped on board in big waves. So it's a bit of a sketchy maneuver, and worried about hurting people and losing people in the water. So they jumped on board, a high five. And then there was four of them. They went into dropping the main, turning the engine on, doing everything it needs to be doing to go in the harbour. And then at one stage, Antoine goes, oh, do you want me to help the helm? You need to go to the bow. We're in the channel now. And then you go into the channel and there's madness. And then your family jumps aboard and you get on the dock and there's people asking you questions. And I just didn't have that 1 hour dream I had of decompressing, right, and kind of having a little bit of time to understand what had just happened. But
right,
it's got benefits to it as well. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's hard to... It was kind of hard not to really have that moment just to appreciate the achievement, I guess.
Coming down the channel with all those people cheering, though, that must be an amazing feeling.
Yeah, I tagged onto the back of the first woman coming in and the new female record. So there was a bunch of people out holding up Swiss flags with Justine on them, but I pretended it was for me. But no, I mean, it was incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, and like a great performance by her as well. She's a bit like yourself. She's been at this quite a long time. And doing her first race as well.
Yeah, I mean, no surprises for anyone that's been following her career, but obviously an amazing achievement, and great for her to have made it and delivered on what everyone knew she was capable of doing.
Now, back to you. We set this podcast up about a week ago, and in that week I've been reading social media messages from your, what is now your old team, because they were wishing you well with as you leave the team. So what's going on?
I mean, it was always planned like that. The aim was to do a Vendée Globe. And for me, it was an amazing experience to do a Vendée Globe within the team that had already sailed that boat around the world. So you got the technical knowledge, you got the performance knowledge of basically hitting the ground running. And for a first Vendée Globe, that was perfect. But it never had an ambition to last longer than a one race campaign. And the sponsor, the primary sponsor, Advens, made the decision that he wanted to come back to sailing with one boat as opposed to two boats and focus on Thomas' campaign. On top of that, they're doing the Ocean Race, which obviously doesn't make anything cheaper. An amazing race, but fully crewed and lots more logistics adds to the budget. So, yeah, it's the natural moment to part ways and on no bad terms at all. It's up to me now to try and set up a campaign for the next edition and probably with a more independent management to step up a level and go for the win for the next race.
Now, how do you do that? You're a solo sailor. Are you surrounded by a little team of people who are helping you with this, or is it just Sam with his WhatsApps and his phone calls?
Yes, I mean, it's a transition period for sure. I'm fortunate enough to be surrounded by people who I've worked with already, have been part of the campaign and want to help. I've got contacts with a few partners already, which we're working hard on, and a few, I mean, exactly what it's going to look like the next campaign, I don't know, and how, but the desire and the ambition to make it happen is strong. So yeah, apart from that, it's hard to know exactly how things are going to pan out, but you can have to look under every rock and see what comes good.
And your plans for sailing for this season while you're campaigning in the background for sponsors?
I made a fairly conscious effort to not get wound up about it during the Vendée Globe and before the Vendée Globe, and said, like, I've been spending 15, 20 years to try and do this Vendée Globe. I knew at the end that this campaign was coming to end. But I said, if I now go into looking for sponsors, trying to drum up interest and spend my time doing that in the last 2-3 months before the Vendée, and then spend my time in the Vendée worrying about it and what's happening to land, about what's happening, and where we are and trying to get things signed, then I'm probably going to not enjoy the Vendée as much. So I made a fairly conscious effort to not do that as much as possible. It's not entirely possible to 100%, but at least not to prioritize it, which was great. And I think I wouldn't change that for anything, but it's meant I've come back now and we're just over a month after the finish of the Vendée, and things, I'm not sure yet. It's basically what I'm trying to say to you, but yeah, we'll wait and see. If it's a year, I need to have a bit less sailing and have a bit more time off, it's not a bad time to do it. And it's obviously quite big energy levels needed to make a Vendée campaign happen. So yeah, having a rest and not just going head down straight into another campaign and without thinking about any time off and what we're going to do is not a bad thing to do. Just make sure you use that time to make sure the next year and the following years are going to be ready to go and have a competitive campaign.
Sounds like a good plan. Sam, thank you so much for talking to me today, taking the time. I really appreciate it. It's great to be finally talking to you after you've done a Vendée Globe campaign. So thanks a million, and let's check in again maybe later in the year when you might know a bit more about what's going on.
Yeah, great. Thanks a lot, Justin.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. We will be back soon with another top name interview, but in the meantime, check out yachtracinglife.com for more great content from across the sailing world.